welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Our first interview is with Dr. Rebecca Hug. She'll tell us how multitasking, skipping meals, and running on too little sleep drains our concentration and our focus. What can we do to sharpen our minds? And a bit later, we'll head to the Midwest where some growers are obsessed with raising pumpkins the size of cars. And later, grab a blanket and look up. With a new moon tonight, Chuck Lura in his natural North Dakota tells us there may not be a better time to check out the autumn sky. Main Street begins today with Dr. Rebecca Hug, a licensed counselor and instructor at the University of Phoenix. She's going to visit with us about focus. We all know how frustrating it is to lose concentration on an important task, especially when we're juggling so many things at once these days, i.e. smartphones. In fact, research shows that multitasking feels productive, but really slows us down, and it slows our brains down. And today, Dr. Hug will explain that everyday behaviors like juggling devices, skipping meals, or racing through our to-do lists quietly undermine our concentration, and maybe she'll give us a couple strategies to stop doing those things. Dr. Hug, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
All right, please be honest. When someone tells you, I'm a great multitasker, do you resist the urge to whip out a gold medal from your pocket and just give it to them as a gold medal in distraction?
Mostly I have to keep myself from laughing, I think, because multitasking is not actually possible. We've been given this lie that we can do multiple things at the same time, and our brains just can't do that. In fact, what's happening is we're shifting from one concept quickly to another. And that's great. But when we do this over and over and over again, all the time throughout the day, what we're actually doing is decreasing our ability to focus on anything or to get anything done. And so multitasking is actually harming our ability to be productive and to be focused and in tune with what's going on right now in the moment.
So is it because our brains kind of work like smartphones, or at least we treat them that way? We expect them to run nonstop, maybe even on low battery, with a dozen apps open all at the same time. We can handle that stuff in our head, right?
I like to think that we have lots of tabs open in our head, but we still have to switch between each of those tabs. They if they're going on in the background, they're just distracting from one another, and it's making our battery go down over time. So opening up one tab at a time is much better than having 17 open and trying to function off of all of them at the same time, for sure.
Counting my internet browser as we speak right now, and I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tabs sitting up there with stuff I'm going to be doing in the next few minutes. So I feel bad already just visiting with you. But why does this impact humans, I guess us? Because I'm as guilty as anyone from not being able just to be present in the moment without my mind spinning on, okay, what's next, or how could I have done that better, and all of those things. What is it about us as humans that kind of go contrary to what it is we're talking about?
It's human nature that we are creative and that we are curious and that we want to figure out what's next and what's better. That's a beautiful thing about our brains. It's also something that can easily get us sidelined in the structures that we have now for our society. There are expectations that we go to work, there are expectations that we raise families, and all of these pieces are where our focus should be. Instead, we want to create and have all this time for our brain to wander. Unfortunately, we just don't have the space to do that. So that's one of the reasons that our focus is off track, is because we don't have the space to actually think through all the things that we want to as humans.
I put myself in my place when I want to read. I like to read, and I don't read as much as I would like to. Put myself in a space with classical music playing in the background, and I don't normally listen to classical music, but that's, for me, what allows me to focus on the book that I'm reading instead of letting the mind drift into, oh, geez, the Mariners did lose last night. Gosh darn it, wanted them to win, et cetera, et cetera, right? And so I guess let's get into the science of distraction. Why do we get distracted?
Yeah, we get distracted because our brains want to be engaged. They want to understand. They want to know. And so when we have all of these things going on in our life, we want to pick up on every single thing that's happening. That could be as small as the slight shift in someone's facial reaction when we're speaking with them, all the way to the ping of your phone with some breaking news that's happening and everything in between. So that's one of the ways that we are attracted to the things that help us know more or be creative or extend beyond what we already have in our wheelhouse. That's the key of distraction, really.
Think of those things that are pushed to me, and I try to limit those. I really do. And I always install an app, and all of a sudden they're pushing me stuff. And it's just like, what did I do wrong in the installation process? I see things from the Associated Press on my phone. But I thought to myself, well, big deal if I wouldn't have learned about that 30 minutes from now when I could have sat down and looked at the news and stuff. But people are pressing stuff to us, they're in the business of making us distracted, it seems to me.
Yes, and we were never meant to be that accessible at all times. Having the distractions through notifications, through emails, subscriptions, anything from a new item popping up, to alert you from a store, to a work email, or that family member who you really don't want to contact you and they just texted you. All of those pieces, we were never meant to be that accessible. And so what you are speaking to of having your space and your time to be able to focus, that's really what we have to be able to do with the distractions of life. And so if you need to have alerts on, that's great. Set them for only when you're working, if that's the type of alert that you're getting. Being able to remove yourself from email lists or have the ping on your phone or your smartwatch be not something that's happening is going to actually increase your ability to focus. And then you can set aside a time, maybe 10 minutes max, to check all of those notifications that you typically would be getting throughout the day.
I've resisted buying a smartwatch. I think for that reason, right? Okay, so yeah, I want to know what time it is. That's cool. And I guess it has some health benefits, et cetera, et cetera. But then all of a sudden you watch people and they get a text and they're looking down at their watch. They get an alert, they're looking down at their watch. And again, the culture is there, but it does bleed into even now the workplace. The expectation is that we are alert and available. So it goes well beyond the science. It's just we're expected to be able to be connected. Should our workplaces celebrate that ability to connect and communicate all the time?
I can't speak to what a workplace should do. However, I can speak to what individuals can be working toward. And that's not always something that's respected or celebrated in the workplace. And that's being able to set boundaries. If we don't have boundaries on when we're available, then that bleeds into everything in our lives. I'm a person who has a family. If I don't set boundaries on when I'm working, that can easily become, oh, give me just a minute, mama needs to do this. And all of a sudden, I have missed all of these opportunities with my kids because I didn't set the boundary to say, here's my work time. Ways I can do that is to set my emails, to say, if you're going to email me between this time and this time, great, I will respond within 48 hours. But if you're emailing me outside of a certain time, it's going to give you an automatic response. My phone is on do not disturb at certain hours. And these are ways that we can be practically setting those boundaries. And it's not in a disrespectful way to our businesses who employ us, but it is a way to communicate consistently over time that this is when I'm working for you and this is when I'm not.
Enjoying my conversation today with Dr. Rebecca Hug. She's a licensed counselor and instructor at the University of Phoenix, and we're talking about focus. All right, we've talked a lot about being interrupted by technology and apps and things. What about other triggers, if you will, that are impacting our ability to focus? Let's start with sleep.
Yes, sleep is something that's necessary for us as humans, if you didn't know, and we often don't get enough of it. And so one of the best things we can be doing is making sure that we're sleeping well, so that when we're awake, we can actually be functioning. What happens during our sleep is that our short-term memory transfers into long-term memory. If we're not getting enough of our sleep, then we can't actually process what has happened during the previous day. So when we awake, we're not going to know how to function at our best because we don't have that history into our long-term memory from the day before. So we got to sleep more, period.
What about nutrition? How does nutrition impact our ability to stay focused? I mean, in notes prepping for this, you talk about missing breakfast, for example.
Yes. Missing breakfast, it's called break fast for a reason. You have to break the fast from when you're sleeping. Hopefully you got enough hours of sleep. But it's important that you fuel your body. Your brain is part of your body. So if you're not eating well, and I'm not just talking eating enough, but eating nutritionally valuable items to fuel every part of your aspect of your energy, including your brain, then you're not going to do well during the day. It's not just the meal, it's what you're eating as well.
Exercise, I've got to believe, impacts our ability to focus.
It does. We're meant to move. That's why we have the ability to get up and to move around. And so if we are not moving our body, if we're not stretching, then what happens is our body starts to shut down and our brain happens to go with it. So the more we move, the more our brain can focus.
So I subscribed to Peloton and I love their spinning classes, except now I've been doing them since COVID. So I find that even though I have the music up, I hop on the bike and here we go and we start the class and then all of a sudden, what do I got to do Saturday? It's just like, focus on what's in front of you and quit doing that other stuff. What advice do you have for me in that situation, even while I'm working out, paying attention to just one thing?
Well, there's a few things in that. So I'll speak to exercise is a beautiful thing. And when you're cycling, for example, or when you're running or walking, that is simulating bilateral stimulation. That's a fancy term for saying that your brain is moving your body from right and left. And when you do that, you're actually processing at a much higher speed and a much deeper skill than when you're just sitting. So when you're cycling, it's actually pretty normal for your brain to wander, and that's not a bad thing, unless you're trying to train for something really big. Mm-hmm. It's good for you to have that bilateral stimulation right and left, because you often can go and say, oh, I'm going to go for a walk. And then all of a sudden, that issue that you couldn't figure out, now you have clarity around it. And that's why our brain is responding to our body's movement, saying, ah, that's what I need to do right here. And that's how we can focus and solve a lot of our issues just by moving our body.
I better DM Emma Lovewell just to let her know that it's okay every now and then if I lose my focus. Is losing focus sometimes, Dr. Hug, something, a symbol of maybe something deeper, like stress or maybe even something physically up with us?
Yes, I'll take it more of the mental route. That's kind of my background. So we have these neural networks in our brain. And what happens is when we are under stress, when we feel like we are failures or we're not getting enough done, or we're lazy because we chose to sit down instead of doing that work subject, whatever it was, we get so hard on ourselves that we're actually negatively impacting the way our brain functions through those neural networks. So what happens is the negative phrases turn into beliefs, and those beliefs turn into action or inaction that just tells us exactly if we're lazy or not, tells us if we are a failure or not. And so when we're thinking about focus, one of the best things we can do is to stop those thoughts and actually refocus again on what the positive is. I'm allowed to rest. I'm allowed to focus right now, or I'm even capable of focusing right now. But giving ourselves a break, it's not just the physical, it's the mental as well.
So my wife makes lists and I bust on her for it periodically, as she would tell you. And in reading again for this interview, sometimes it seems making lists might prevent us from being focused. Is something that you talk about, really?
It's a give and a take. So there are different ways you can use lists as a strategy to be helpful, in some ways that it just gets in the way. If a task can take less than 2 minutes, do it. Don't make a list about it, just get it done, because the time you're going to take to do the list is the same time it takes to get that item done. If you're going to make a list, make sure that it's something that is either the things that pop into your head and you can write them down so that they're written down somewhere, you can come back to them and stay focused on whatever's in front of you. Or if you are a long list maker, like it sounds like your wife is and I am as well, I like to separate into three categories. And the categories that I've come up with are: what is on fire in the frying pan? What is in the pantry? So what have I committed to, but I haven't quite gotten to using yet? And what is still at the store? What is it that I know I have to go get at some point, but it's not something I've yet committed to? And that's typically going to boil down to, what do I need to do today or even right now in this hour? That's that in the fire, in the frying pan on fire. If it is in the pantry, it's probably in the next 48 hours or at least by the end of the week. And then what is at the store is going to be in the next month. Being able to prioritize and separate is another really good strategy to help with focus in the moment right now.
Now I want to get into what your favorite recipes are and all that kind of stuff. You made me lose track already, right? I'm wondering, man, Dr. Hug must be a great, great, great baker or a great chef. All right. You talk about reclaiming focus. Does that mean building willpower, Dr. Hug? And can we even do that over time?
Yes, we can. And I'm not sure it's willpower more than training our brain, just like you would train your body. Being able to train your brain is telling yourself to stop. Sometimes that's the best thing we can do. Our brains tend to go somewhere else. What is this person thinking about me? What is it that I have to do? Oh, I forgot to do this thing. And if we can stop and if we can come back to the present moment, then we're able to focus a lot better. That's one of the best things we can do. That's actually a cognitive behavioral technique, is the stop method, or the thought stopping method. So if it's socially appropriate, you can say out loud. If not, say it in your head. You would say stop. And then you would actually say, what is it that I can do right now? And you can train yourself, instead of saying those negative statements we talked about, instead of saying I'm a failure, say I'm doing the best I can right now. Or instead of I'm lazy, I can focus on what I need to right now. And so over time, when you stop and then you retrain your brain instead of those negative statements to the positive and take action on it, then you're able to train yourself to actually have what you call the willpower, what I would call is the skill to focus and to move forward.
What do you tell kids who are addicted to their phones?
I would say it's not just kids, but often I would say to them nothing. What I would do instead is, if it's appropriate, simply just reach out and touch their arm and say, I'm here and I'm happy to talk with you. And that's not just with counseling, that's with anyone you work with, because so often there's this desire to be connected and this fear that you won't be connected that keeps you distracted rather than focusing on the relationships that are available to you right in the moment. So the phones are great and they actually do serve as a good connection, especially for younger populations. However, if the goal is to connect and to focus on the present moment in the relationship, simply distracting by saying, I'm here, is one of the best strategies.
So if we're working on our focus, if we're trying to improve our focus, how can that really make us happier? And I ask it from the context of, if I'm worried about now just one thing, I'm being with you, Dr. Hug, in the moment, I'm not worried about anything else that happened last night or it's going to happen later today. How can that make me happier?
This is one of the things I hear often from my clients, is they just want to be happy. And what I think we miss is that content is a version of happy, and connected is an aspect of being content. We as humans are meant to be connected to other people. However, we have to learn to be content and not just overwhelmingly excited about some huge topic like we see in TV shows or we see in Instagram or whatever it might be about how we connect. So what we're looking for is the ability to be content in the moment, be content in the connection. And through that, we can find that there is meaning. That's what separates us as humans. We are meaning makers. If we can make meaning out of this moment, that there is something special that we are having in this conversation right now, then I will be supported as a human and I will feel like I'm supporting you as a human. That is the epicenter of contentness, which then can breed and lead into happiness.
Seems like everything that I'm thinking about goes back to cell phones. Do you? And I think back then to my parents, right? We had dinner around the dinner table. That distraction just simply wasn't there. So I'm wondering, maybe hoping, that you advocate for us, plan time in your day when the cell phone is in the other room and you can't hear it and you're not worried about it. Do you structure that into your life, Dr. Hug?
Yes. So a few strategies around focus when it comes to cell phones. And again, this is not just for younger generations. This is for all of us because we're all guilty of it.
I'm listening. I'm listening. Let's go.
One of the best things to do, especially if you're in your office or at home and you don't necessarily need your phone as a device for your work at that moment, is to have a home base for it. So my phone sits in one specific spot in my home at all times. If I want to look up something or check something or order something, I need to go to that spot. I take the moment I need to do whatever that is, and I put the phone back down, and then I come back to my life, where my kids are, where my family is. And that's a way that I don't just carry my phone with me everywhere. Likewise, we sit down for dinner every night with our family. That's really important. I think it's an important piece if you have that opportunity to live in that way. And our phones are set aside. There's a basket literally for phones. And that's what we do. If we go out to eat and we have phones in our pockets, they go in a pile. And whoever picks up their phone first, we joke, will pay for dinner. However, when you have kids, they end up having you pay. But those are some strategies. Give it a home base, give it a place to sit. It is not an appendage to you. It is a part of how you communicate, and only that. So let it go.
I would guess too that focusing on community and social interactions is awfully important in this discussion, that we don't want to keep ourselves in isolation.
Correct.
Tell me more about that, the importance of interacting with folks in a group, with folks wherever we go, relative to isolating ourselves with the phone or with another device where we don't have that exercise in community.
So I think there's at least two perspectives that are coming up. And the first is, I do want to honor that for many people, utilizing devices, smartphones, whatever they might be, is their mode for connection and communication. And so I want to honor that for folks who don't have the mobility or don't have the lack of anxiety to engage as we would traditionally see in a group setting outside of the home. I will say, when we do get together in groups, one of the best ways to focus on developing those relationships and seeking that happiness that we've talked about is being able to put down your phone. Yes, there are moments to take a great photo, but you shouldn't be working on anything else other than that relationship. Now, there are times that you can get together and there are online gamers who sit next to one another and they game together. That's a beautiful sense of community as well. So there are different ways to do this, but if you are in a traditional or outside of the home or getting together, put down the phone and look at each other. You might learn something new about yourself even.
You could assign us all one focus experiment that you want us all to try for a week. All right, we're your guinea pigs. Let's go.
I think the biggest one would be trying to remove your energy expenditure of being emotionally tied to what could be. That sounds very convoluted, so let's break that down.
You're telling
What
us to
that
stop
looks
dreaming?
like.
I mean, that's, I asked that somewhat seriously.
Dreaming is a beautiful way for our brain to be creative. Worrying is an undirected version of dreaming about what people might be thinking or saying or doing, or what they could have been or should have been thinking or saying or doing. And we make these storylines in our head. And often that can not only decrease severely our ability to be happy, it can also remove us from the moment, and then it takes away our focus. We're so worried about what could be or what isn't, that we don't know what actually is right now and what we could be happy about in this moment.
I like your phrasing it that way. Enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Rebecca Hug. She's reminded us that common habits like switching tasks too often, skipping meals, or even not sleeping enough can undermine our ability to concentrate and focus. Dr. Hug, thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, pumpkins bigger than cars, plus the perfect time to look up at the North Dakota sky. That's ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Giant pumpkins can top the scales at more than 2,000 pounds. And for a few dedicated growers across the Midwest, raising these mammoth gourds is practically a full-time job. In suburban Chicago, Joe Atkins tends his backyard, pumpkin house, where car-sized pumpkins stretch across a blanket of vines. Reporter Peter Medlin with Harvest Public Media introduces us to the growers and dreamers chasing the next world record.
The pumpkin house sits in a quiet neighborhood in suburban Chicagoland.
Come on in here.
If you drive by, you'd never expect some of the Midwest's biggest pumpkins grow here in Joe Atkins' backyard garden.
Yeah, I grow the ones that are under a pound all the way up to hopefully a couple thousand pounds.
Joe's won the Illinois Giant Pumpkin Growers Association's annual weigh-off multiple years in a row. And last year, he cracked a personal milestone, his first 2,000-pound pumpkin. He's always loved pumpkins, but it was actually pumpkin carving that got him into pumpkin growing. He just wanted a bigger canvas.
I decided that I wanted to carve these big pumpkins like this, and I couldn't find them anywhere to buy them. So I thought, well, let me give it a shot. I'll try to grow one, and then I can carve it that way. And I couldn't believe how much I loved growing those pumpkins.
Cultivating a giant pumpkin patch is a ton of work year-round. Joe sprays fungicide, prunes and berries vines, even sets up fans to stop moisture and rot.
It's literally like 4 or 5 hours a day. I've got a schedule. On Sundays and Tuesdays, I do about 8 hours.
Here's a wild thing about giant pumpkins. They get that heavy really fast. In June and July, they can grow more than 50 pounds in one day. And Joe's 2,000-pounder is not the Illinois state record, and it's not even close to the world record. That recently belonged to Minnesota horticulture teacher Travis Ginger. In 2023, he drove his giant pumpkin to California and set the world record.
Okay. I'm going to hit the switch right now. 2,749!
It was the realization of a lifelong dream. His dad grew big pumpkins, and as a teenager, he announced to his classmates that he would break the world record one day. Ginger says back then, the record was 700 or 800 pounds. It's tripled since and not slowing down.
It's gotten kind of crazy, and I mean, now a new grower can go grow a 2,000-pounder, no problem. It takes a lot of work, don't get me wrong, but the world of the internet has really pushed this thing quite a bit.
As the pumpkins grow and records shatter, the technology and techniques get more sophisticated. Growers can spend hundreds of dollars for just one seed. Some grow these pumpkins on scales inside climate-controlled greenhouses hooked up to sensors. And the hobby itself is also growing. There are giant pumpkin weigh-offs and festivals all over the country. Del Faust is the president of the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers, and he says their group has doubled in size to 200 members since he joined in 2012, and Wisconsin recently hosted an international growers conference.
The worldwide one last year was up in Green Bay at Lambeau Field, so people from all over the world came to learn more about growing giant pumpkins.
I got 31 on this one.
Back in Illinois, this year's weigh-off is getting started. Joe Atkins looks to defend his title from a field of 12 or so other growers.
If it's your first time joining us, welcome! If it's not, welcome back!
Pumpkins up to 1,500 pounds tip the scale through the afternoon, but it comes down to the last pumpkin, Joe's pumpkin, and the weight to beat is 1882. The pumpkin lasso latches onto a forklift and gently hoists the giant gourd into the sky. The crowd holds their breath and looks to the scale.
2,026 pounds!
Yeah! Joe wins, beating his personal record by just 5 pounds. And then he loads up his prize winner onto the trailer to haul it home. He plans to carve it for Halloween and hand out seeds to trick-or-treaters, hopefully to inspire the next generation of giant pumpkin growers. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Peter Medlin.
That was Peter Medlin with Harvest Public Media and his story, Good Gourd. These Midwesterners are raising giant pumpkins that weigh as much as a car. It's part of a collaboration of covering food, farming, and rural life stories across the Midwest and Great Plains. You can find more at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Last week, we reported on a nickel refinery in Oklahoma that is built on the historic reservation of the Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache tribal nations. But as KOSU's Sarah Lisi reports, Westwind Elements is operating without their consent, which is causing frustration stemming from century-old decisions about tribal sovereignty.
Shut down Westwind!
Let's shut it down!
A half dozen protesters gather at a busy intersection in the southwest Oklahoma city of Lawton. The protesters are united in their fight against a nickel refinery in town called Westwind Elements.
Our city officials have really made a career out of ignoring people like me, like women, women of color, indigenous people, people of color.
That's Kesa Whitley. She's Kiowa and absentee Shawnee. She's also the coalition coordinator of Westwind Resistance, a grassroots organization dedicated to pushing back against Westwind Elements.
We're not defending nature. We are nature defending itself.
One thing that stands in the way of nature's defense is the past itself. Brian Hosmer is an Oklahoma State University history professor.
The problem is power, differential power.
Back in 1867, the Kiowas, Comanches, and Apaches reached an agreement with the federal government in the Medicine Lodge Treaty, which established the boundaries of the KCA Reservation. It says this is their land, and
there could be no changes to the tribal, the reservation domain, absent a three-quarter vote from the males on the reservation.
Through some trickery and manipulation by the federal government, the KCA was ultimately divided up and claimed by indigenous and non-tribal citizens around 1900.
It's one of the biggest land grabs in that era. Yeah, I mean, and this is one of the things that I think is not discussed enough in terms of the history of allotment.
Then Kiowa leader Lone Wolf turned to the federal justice system for relief and lost. Plenary authority was solidified in Lone Wolf's ruling, which means Congress can treat tribal nations as subjects to be governed rather than sovereign entities. Lauren Spotted Bird is the chairman of the Kiowa tribe.
The only person or the only entity that has plenary authority over any person is God himself, and Congress is not God.
To him and fellow KCA leaders, their reservation is still intact. There are other roadblocks to fighting against Westwind Elements, too. Comanche Nation Chairman Forrest Hadanipa says that's largely because the tribes don't have what's known as treatment as a state authority. And it's extremely difficult for Oklahoma tribes to get, thanks to a midnight rider that was tacked onto a 2005 appropriations bill.
I think from our tribal members, sometimes they don't understand how stacked the deck is against us.
Not having treatment as a state designation means they don't have the power to set their own water or air quality standards, which could make it harder for industrial companies like Westwind to be built near tribal lands.
And unfortunately, the status quo is not to recognize our sovereignty or our jurisdiction over kind of the broader area. And instead, you know, our jurisdiction has been very cabined to kind of these checkerboard areas.
Back at the protest, cars and semi-trucks pass by the handful of activists exercising their own rights.
By thinking that we have to play their game in their field, that's a part of what's leading to our demise. We as people, as a collective, have to stop that. We're not here to be a part of their system or to even uphold it. We exist outside of it.
Let's shut it down!
Whitley says her ancestors didn't win fights by continuing with this oppressive system. They won by standing against it. For KOSU, I'm Sarah Lisi.
This story is supported by the Earth Journalism Network. Next week, the final feature in this series will highlight what is at stake for both the KCA community and Westwind Elements. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, providing live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for in-person, hybrid, and virtual events, serving clients throughout the Upper Midwest and nationwide. More at livewirenow.com.
How liquid air could help solve the climate crisis. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A major storm that hit small communities in western Alaska about 10 days ago may have been made worse by Trump administration cuts.
Typhoon Halong struck on the weekend of October 11th and 12th. Homes were swept away, and entire communities like Kipnuk were inundated by water 6 feet above the normal tide, the most amount of water that had been seen in living memory.
Forecasting models used data collected by weather balloons, but because of cuts to the National Weather Service by DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, initially run by Elon Musk, Western Alaska has suffered a large gap in balloon coverage.
The cyclone was predicted to move through the Bering Sea, but instead veered to the east, striking the Alaskan communities, which were not in the original forecasts.
The typhoon's final track and its intensity weren't clear until about 36 hours before crossing into Alaskan waters, which was too late for evacuations from the remote regions.
The area of western Alaska where the typhoon hit is flat, and storms can push the ocean into a delta where it spreads out. Rick Toman, a climate specialist with the University of Alaska, wrote in The Conversation that the permafrost is thawing and the land subsiding, so sea level rise is an additional threat.
Since the 1950s, there have been intense efforts to save green sea turtles from extinction, including devices that prevent them from getting caught in fishing nets, laws like the Endangered Species Act in the U.S., and international treaties. Also, conservationists have protected nesting females and their eggs.
Now, those efforts appear to have worked. Sea turtle numbers have increased around the globe by nearly 30% since the 1970s, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature. And last week, it was announced that they've been reclassified from endangered to least concern.
Brian Wallace of the University of Colorado Boulder, leader of the recent assessment, told NPR that the turtles were once so abundant that sailors on Christopher Columbus's voyages could navigate around land at night by the sound of the turtles breathing and their hard shells hitting the boats.
That level of abundance has not been reached, as populations of sea turtles are still significantly lower compared to the pre-colonization era. Also, there are worries about some turtles in the Indian and Pacific Oceans and low nesting numbers in places like Costa Rica.
Renewable energy is soaring around the globe, but one obstacle to its growth has been how to store the electricity to use it when the sun isn't shining or the wind's not blowing. The solution to that problem may be blowing in the wind, in the air we breathe.
Liquefied air, to be exact. It's air that's been cooled to the point it liquefies and can be stored in a tank, acting like a battery. When electricity is needed, the air is heated and expands to drive turbines that generate power.
The liquid air energy storage technology was first developed in the 1970s, but wasn't put into use because it's expensive. The growth of renewables now means it could be cost-effective and a faster way to get off fossil fuels.
To that point, the BBC reports that the world's first commercial-scale liquid air energy storage facility is being built in Manchester, England.
Its developer, Highview Power, expects the system to come online in 2027 and have the capacity to store enough electricity from renewables to power nearly 500,000 homes.
If it catches on, it could be a game-changer for the storage aspect of the renewable energy paradigm. Currently, electrical grids rely on pumped hydro and lithium batteries for storage, but those have drawbacks. Pumped hydro relies on water and only works in certain locations. Lithium mining has environmental impacts, and the batteries last only around 10 years.
In contrast, liquid air storage facilities use above-ground tanks, which can be situated practically anywhere, and they store energy for longer. The best part? The process runs on air, an abundant natural resource.
And finally, did you know that billiard balls once helped to save elephants?
Back in the 1800s, playing pool was a popular pastime, and billiard balls were made from ivory. Unfortunately, a single elephant tusk yielded only 4 or 5 balls, putting the animals at risk.
So, in 1864, Scientific American announced a competition by a billiard table manufacturer offering $10,000 to anyone who could come up with a better ball.
A New Yorker named John Wesley Hyatt won the contest with a solution made from celluloid, a moldable material made from cellulose together with camphor and ground-up cow bones, the first plastic.
Instead of accepting the cash prize and calling it a day, Hyatt patented his invention and started his own company, which celebrated his billiard balls and advertisements as a conservation success story that assured the survival of endangered animals.
The rest is history, as they say. Hyatt's invention has led to our current microplastics problem, which not only threatens wildlife in our oceans, but also human health, putting us behind the proverbial eight ball.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 2, Music from Within, with works by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Bloch, and performance by Maestro Christopher Zimmerman on piano and principal flute Deb Harris. November 8th and 9th at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Details at fmsymphony.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Tonight's new moon means dark skies, and that's great news for sky watchers. And now, nature is putting on a celestial double feature. Meteor shower sparked by debris from Halley's Comet reaches its peak now. With clear skies, you may see as many as 20 meteors an hour, and maybe even a few brighter fireballs. So bundle up, head outside, and look up. The universe has a show planned for you, says Chuck Lura in this natural North Dakota.
There's a new moon coming up on the 21st, and you know what that means. It's prime time for some stargazing. Plus, there are a couple meteor showers putting on their annual show. The Orionid meteor shower puts on its annual show each year from around the 1st of October through early November as the Earth passes through the debris field of Halley's Comet. Although the meteors may be observed anywhere in the sky, meteor showers are named for the constellation in which the meteors appear to originate, and in this case, it's the constellation Orion. The peak viewing period this year will come up on the night of October 21st in early hours of the 22nd. Observers can expect to see up to 20 meteors or more per hour during the peak viewing period. So if the sky is clear, in combination with the new moon, conditions could not get much better. Plus, the Orionids are known to be a bit unpredictable, with occasional outbursts and fireballs. So make a point to check it out. There's another rather minor meteor shower also putting on a show now. The Taurids meteor shower runs from early September into early December. And although the peak viewing period for this show will not occur until the evening of November 4th and early hours of the 5th, it can be expected to add a few meteors to the show. And like the Orionids, these meteors may be observed anywhere in the sky, but in this case will appear to originate within the constellation Taurus. In addition to checking out the meteor showers, consider doing a little sky watching. The Milky Way always seems to elicit a sense of wonder. And consider checking out a constellation or two. There are lots of aids available on the internet, local library, and bookstore to assist you if you need a reference or some help. And of course, there's an app for that. So find a comfortable place to take in the celestial show over the next few weeks. I've put links to sources of information on the meteor showers and fall constellations, including an app review from Outside Magazine, along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. Ever been woken up really early in the morning by this sound? And before you know it, you and every rooster in the neighborhood are wide awake before the sun has even risen. Roosters don't need to set an alarm to tell them when it's time to crow. Their internal circadian clock lets them anticipate sunrise with remarkable accuracy, even in complete darkness. To us sleepy humans, it may seem like they all start crowing at once, but it turns out that the first bird to call isn't just early, he's the boss. Chickens are deeply social animals. In small flocks, where they all know each other, usually groups with fewer than 10 birds, they form what's called a pecking order. It's a stable social hierarchy where every chicken knows its place. In this structure, dominant roosters get first dibs on everything. Food, mates, roosting places, and even crowing order. Researchers found that the reigning rooster gets to crow first while the others wait their turn. If the top rooster is removed, the next ranking bird in the pecking order steps up to take his place, and so on. In the barnyard, only one bird gets the honor of announcing the new day and waking you up. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 21st. Early in 1902, the United Mine Workers called for a strike in the anthracite coal fields of eastern Pennsylvania. They demanded safer working conditions and higher wages. The mine owners refused to meet with the union. George F. Bayer, leader of the operators, insisted that so-called labor agitators did not have the best interests of the miners at heart. He claimed the owners would protect the workers' rights. The miners went on strike May 12, 1902. At the time, railroads and factories ran on coal, and homes were heated by coal. A coal strike promised hard times for Americans. By August, newspapers in North Dakota sounded the alarm over a looming coal famine. The Devil's Lake Interocean newspaper warned that a coal shortage was imminent. There were real concerns among North Dakotans who were worried about keeping warm through the winter. Coal would be expensive if it was available at all, and North Dakota winters were cold. People were anxious about the coming season. By October, that anxiety had reached the White House. Although his attorney general advised him he had no legal authority to intervene, President Teddy Roosevelt feared untold misery with the certainty of riots which might develop into social war. He called an unprecedented meeting, summoning both sides to Washington to resolve the issue. He was determined, in his words, to bring an end to a situation which has become literally intolerable. On this date, in 1902, it seemed Roosevelt's plan was doomed. The owners refused to negotiate without concessions. The strikers didn't trust the owners and refused to concede before talks even began. In a desperate move, Roosevelt appointed Commissioner of Labor Carol Wright to lead the newly formed Anthracite Coal Strike Commission. Wright met with both the union and the owners and ran the meeting with a strong hand. To everyone's surprise, both sides agreed to submit their disputes to the commission for arbitration. The strike ended on October 23rd, with both parties agreeing to honor the commission's decision. The country heaved a sigh of relief, knowing there would be heat for the winter. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public,
Know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that wraps up this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on Main Street, press rewind with us as we go to Bismarck State College to preview Humanities Mixtape, Rewinding the 1980s, a three-day celebration of the decade that gave us MTV, big hair, and big ideas. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.